I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today we're going to catch up with the guy who left a seven-figure job at Microsoft because he met a man in Nepal who said, perhaps you could come back with books. But first, the latest from Pakistan. There was cheering today after President Pervez Musharraf's televised announcement of his resignation. News footage showed groups of people celebrating in the streets in several towns, some of them firing automatic weapons into the sky. And Pakistan's stock market and currency both rose strongly on hopes that Musharraf's resignation will bring about political stability. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice praised Musharraf for his fight against terrorism and promised the U.S. would continue working with the country's leaders. Well, Najm Sethi is editor of the Daily Times newspaper in Lahore. Najm, Musharraf came to power in a military coup in 1999. He'd already stepped down as the country's military leader. And today we see these pictures of Pakistanis cheering his resignation as president. But is that a universal feeling there?
I don't think there is too much cheering, although you did hear some, because that's party politically motivated. But yes, most people did want him to go, but they're very apprehensive about what happens next.
Well, what does happen next? In the interim, just outline for us who takes over, how does the country go forward?
Well, technically speaking, he's already resigned. His resignation has been accepted by the Speaker of Parliament, so that's the end of the line for him. Now, in terms of what happens next, well, there will be a new interim president. He will be the chairman of the Senate. He will be president until a new president is elected. And the new election has to take place in the next 30 days.
There are two players in Pakistan. There's former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and Asif Ali Zardari, both leaders of the two main parties in government. Are they interested in being candidates for the presidency that Musharraf is stepping down from?
No, I think Mr. Zardari was interested, but I don't think it's possible. Mr. Zardari will field his own candidate and Mr. Sharif will field his own candidate. There is no way either one of them will want to be president because they now mean to put their heads together and carry out a constitutional amendment to strip the presidency of all the powers that Musharraf had accumulated while he was president.
Well, it was understood that Musharraf was trying to make a deal in stepping down to avoid impeachment in Pakistan's parliament. There are some who say he should be tried for treason after his authoritarian rule. Does his resignation include immunity from prosecution?
That's understood, and not least because that was a demand put forward by the Pakistan Army. They don't want one of their former chiefs and commanders to be impeached. But Mr. Sharif is going to play to the popular gallery. He's going to demand that Mr. Musharraf be hauled up for treason. I don't think the government will give in on that because that's part of the understanding.
We've talked about technically what happens in Pakistan. What happens for the direction of the country? At one time, Musharraf was seen as the hope of a liberal Islamic democracy. Now there's been the tug of the Taliban and fundamentalists. What direction is the country going to go in now with Musharraf stepping down?
People want these politicians to stop squabbling and get on with a couple of very important issues. One is bread and butter, the other is the war on terror. Now, the thing is that I don't think they're going to be in a position to do either. There is the other question of how to restore the judges who were sacked by Musharraf. Mr. Zardari is in no hurry to do that, and Mr. Nawaz Sharif wants that to happen in the next 24 hours. So I think the better part of the next 30 days or so is going to be taken up with these two issues, which is to say that the issues of economy and the war on terror and foreign policy are all going to be held in abeyance. And I think that's where the real problems lie, because if they don't turn their attention to those major issues, the people of this country are going to say enough is enough. You told us this man was a problem, you got rid of him, but you're still squabbling amongst yourselves. When are you going to talk about the real things that matter to us?
How was Musharraf's government perceived as far as, you know, the search for Osama bin Laden and fighting insurgents on the border with Afghanistan? And what is the sense that there will be the stomach for those two battles, which the U.S., of course, wants, with a new leader?
Well, that's the big question, and it's ironical that the United States was accusing Musharraf of not doing enough, and the people of Pakistan were saying, you've done more than enough. So he was in a vice. He got it at both ends. And I think that's the problem now. The army has formally handed over what they call ownership of the war on terror to the civilians. The army has said to the Americans and it has said to the civilians, you tell us what you want to do. And of course, the civilians don't want to conduct this war on terror. A majority of Pakistanis think this is not their war. They think this is America's war. That is what brought Musharraf down. This new civilian dispensation is going to be in no position to conduct this war in any meaningful sense.
Najm Sethi, editor of the Daily Times in Pakistan, speaking to us from Lahore after the announced resignation of Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf. Najm, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, you're a millionaire. Now what? More Americans than ever are facing that question. As of 2006, there were nearly 9 million millionaires in the U.S., a very large number of them in the high-tech hotspots on the West Coast. Microsoft alone had created, according to the New York Times, approximately 10,000 millionaires by the year 2000. Well, our next guest, John Wood, was one of them. You might remember he told his story in the 2006 bestseller, Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, An Entrepreneur's Odyssey to Educate the World's Children, how he joined Microsoft in 1991, quickly rose to become the company's man in China, but quit almost 10 years later to found the charity Room to Read to educate children around the world. So what happened after his splash on the bestseller list and Oprah's couch? Let's find out. John Woods joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
You said you wanted to be the Andrew Carnegie of global libraries. You know, he built, what, over 2,000 in the U.S. So tell us, how are you doing? How's it going?
Well, my thanks to the local Room to Read teams around the world, we are making great progress in being the Carnegie of the developing world, bringing libraries to kids who have never had access to books. We think we'll have over 10,000 libraries open, serving 5 million kids by the end of the year 2010.
But is there an epilogue? I mean, this is a pretty heady, successful story, but is there an epilogue, too, of what I did wrong, what I learned, how, when it got hard?
Oh, you'll always learn things, I think, because what we're doing has never been done before. And I always tell my teams, you know, if this was easy, it would have been done by now. I mean, everybody wants kids in the developing world to have access to books. But when you're talking about setting up libraries in post-apartheid South Africa or post-Khmer Rouge Cambodia, certainly it's not easy. But I think that's all the more reason we have to focus and be long-term investors.
Well, for instance, you've said you don't take money from the American government because you don't want to get caught up in any ideological problems of any administration, you know, whether or not you could have books about condoms or, you know, any of those restrictions that a government might put on you. Have any foreign governments restricted the kinds of children's books you can put in libraries or the kinds of reading you can put in libraries?
They haven't, because the way that Room to Read works is we outsource the decision to the local level. The decision of what books get into one of the Room to Read libraries is made by our local employees in consultation with the local Ministry of Education. We use local authors and local artists to print books in languages that have never had children's books before. So as much as I'm the spokesperson for Room to Read, it is Nepalese making decisions in Nepal and Zambians making decisions in Zambia.
For those who didn't read your book or see you on Oprah or the rerun, you were with Microsoft, as we said, and on a 3-week trek to Nepal. And you came across a school with a library, but without books?
Yeah, the empty library. No desks, no chairs, no shelves, no books. And the headmaster was very hopeful. He'd hung a sign out in front of the library that clearly said, library. But when you it was an aspirational sign. When you walked in, there were no books. They had 450 students in this school who are all very, very eager to read. And this is, of course, one of millions of villages throughout the poorest parts of the world where this is the catch-22. They're too poor to afford education, but until they have education, how are they ever not going to be poor? So that headmaster spoke a sentence that would, for me, forever change my adult life. And chapter one of my book is called Perhaps, Sir, You Will Someday Come Back with Books.
They had a few books, but they had to keep them locked up, you know, again, another irony, because they didn't want kids to mess them up.
Yeah, and all the books that they had were, you know, 20 books for 450 kids that were all backpacker cast-offs. So I'm no literary snob. I think every child should read Danielle Steele romance novels at some point of their pedagogical development.
But not but, in the library.
Not an 8-year-old Nepali kid.
Well, but so you send an email to your dad about collecting books. You go back to Microsoft to work. Suddenly there's thousands of books. I'm really synopsizing your story, but you and your dad go on this real bonding trip back to Nepal to deliver the books and are greeted with what?
Oh, it was extraordinary to go back to Nepal a year later and deliver those books and make good on that promise to come back with books and to see hundreds of children lined up greeting us with flowers and putting their hands together and saying namaste and bowing to us. And I felt like we had done so little. We had just collected 3,000 used children's books. And one of the teachers grabbed my hand and he looked me in the eye and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, "You have done so much for us and we can do so little in return for you." And I found it hard to explain to him that what he had done is he'd given me the feeling that maybe I had some meaning in my life, that maybe my life wasn't going to be about making rich people richer. It was going to be about helping these kids to get that same gift that all of us have had, that gift of having a library from a young age. Something, having something that basic be missing just makes me question all this prosperity we have. Because if a billion people can't read or write, I feel like it's our job to get out there and help them have access to books.
Well, and you left this very heady world of Microsoft disenchanted with it, we should say. And I read in an article that some people encouraged you not to put all of your disenchantment in your book. But now you find yourself in the charitable world, and you're taking a closer look at that world as well. I mean, you've said that much of the charitable world gets a free pass. What do you mean by that?
I think a lot of people give the charitable world a pat on the back, that if you're trying, that's good, congratulations. But there's not enough people challenging the charitable world to be more effective, to take their solutions to scale. And when you do see the charities, let's say Teach for America, that have begun to go to scale, it's so exciting to see.
What do you mean go to scale?
Go to scale to mean to actually come up with a solution that is in line with the size of the problem. I'll give you an example of this. People say that Room to Read is amazing because we've opened 5,000 libraries in just 8 years. And I say, that's great. We're proud of that. But that's just a complete drop in the bucket, a drop in the ocean.
How many people are illiterate?
There's 800 million illiterate people in the world today, two-thirds of whom are girls and women. And so when I talk about scale, I say, let's not pat ourselves on the back for doing 5,000 libraries. Let's ask ourselves, how could we open 1 million libraries? And until we do that, let's not pop any champagne corks.
You say we need to be the Starbucks of charities.
Well, Starbucks, yes, in terms of actually looking at the market opportunity and saying, can we open outlets quickly? And we have actually benchmarked ourselves at Room to Read vis-a-vis Starbucks. In their 8th year after their initial public offering of stock, they opened 1,000 outlets, which was a lot. In Room to Read's 8th year, we opened 1,600 libraries. And I use that example because I think that if we can take that private sector mindset, and you can't go all private sector or else you lose your soul, but if you can take some of the best of the charitable world and combine it with the best of the business world, then you end up having solutions like what we've come up with at Room to Read. Last year, we opened 4 new libraries a day. That was 1 new library every 6 hours. So it meant that every day, over 1,000 kids in the poorest parts of the world got access to their first library. And that's going to, I think, change the world for a lot of those kids.
Well, what do you think about the questions that are being asked in general about the philanthropic / foreign aid world? Nicholas Kristof writes about a 2007 study by two economists, Rajan and Subramanian. It finds that the picture is muddy at best for what can be accomplished. That let's say if the goal is to save lives short term with vaccinations, that's where aid works best. But if the goal is to make economies grow and countries grow, something almost what you're talking about, that aid and charity doesn't really work.
Well, I think foreign aid's a bit like cholesterol. You know, there's good cholesterol, there's bad cholesterol. There are some fantastic solutions out there. You know, when the Gates Foundation announced that it's going to try to wipe malaria off the face of the earth, wow. That's bold. That's something we should all stand up and applaud for. And that should be a challenge for the billionaires of the world everywhere to follow the example Bill and Melinda are setting, to follow the example Warren Buffett is setting.
That's John Wood. He left Bill Gates' Microsoft to start his own charity, Room to Read. By 2006, he's established 2,500 libraries and 210 schools around the world. We'll have more with him after a break. And later today, the nation's former top auditor is suggesting that we all give up some retirement benefits to reduce the national debt. That's later. Back with more from John Wood in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from John Wood. Microsoft made him a millionaire. He quit, though, and founded a charity called Room to Read. Just before the break, we were asking about how effective charitable work is. And, John, you talked about there being good and bad philanthropy. You think the work that Bill and Melinda Gates or Warren Buffett is doing is good. But you're critical of the bad. Now, why? The papers are, you know, splattered with parties and events, people raising money for charities, and a lot of that money from the new tech boom you were part of. So what's wrong with that?
I think we need to stop talking about how much money people are spending and talk instead about what is actually getting done. Filling the bank account is only one part of the equation. And I think what we need to do is stop giving people a free pass to say, oh, billionaire X committed $100 million to this problem. Let's talk about whether or not they've come up with an effective solution.
And you say you also want to democratize philanthropy, maybe make it less about billionaire X?
Yeah, I think if we wait for the billionaires of the world to solve our problems, it can be like waiting for Godot. And people all the time say, oh, well, Gates is going to solve that. Well, you know, I think everybody can be part of the solution. Everybody should be part of the solution. And quite often the stories of an 11-year-old saving their allowance is equally compelling as whether or not a billionaire gives $100 million to the public library.
Well, and going back to how you run your organization, you just monitor for 3 years to make sure that some of these places haven't converted the library buildings with the bathroom facilities and all of this into chicken coops.
Right.
And then you let it go. For you, it's a bottom line thing. It's the cost of maintaining and running them. The other part, I'm sure, is about teaching them how to fish rather than give them the fish. Are they fishing? How many kids are reading?
A key part of our challenge at Room to Read is basically getting the parents involved in everything, whether it's building a school or constructing a library. One of the problems, I think, going back to your question about foreign aid, is when you give everything to a village, they're not going to value it. You know, the old adage that nobody ever washed a rental car before returning it to the Hertz counter. If you don't feel ownership, then there's no sense taking care of something. So at Room to Read, we devise what we call the challenge grant. Every project has to have parental input, sweat equity, labor, land donations, small amounts of money, so that the parents will value it. And there's nothing quite like seeing a group of parents the day a school opens in Nepal or a library opens in Cambodia, and the parents are so proud because they've put their labor into that project. So we've not given them everything. We've maybe done 50%, 70%, 80% of the resources, but the parents in the community have done the rest. It's almost like an old-fashioned barn raising. But it's happening today in Cambodia, Nepal, and South Africa, where parents are putting their labor in because they want their kids to get a good education.
And do these library buildings and schools remain library buildings and schools? Have any been
taken
over?
They do. They do. Room to Read invests heavily in monitoring and evaluation along with training of the librarians so that we can make sure that things are being well-run. We go back on a quarterly basis, as an example, to the libraries to see, is the library open a set number of hours per week? Is there a checkout system in place? Is the librarian trained? How many kids are visiting the library? Very simple measures that can be done literally on a clipboard with a pencil with somebody visiting the library to see if the conditions are right for that library to be used. And I don't think, you know, every single one of these projects is going to be successful over time. When you open 2,000 libraries in a year, I would be happy if, you know, 90% plus were successful. There's no, I think, ever a guarantee of an outcome. What we are trying to do is guarantee kids the equality of opportunity.
As we said, the whole project was sparked by your own trip to Nepal and the library that had no books. But are you doing anything in the U.S.? I mean, there are problems with books and libraries in the U.S. and with reading levels in the U.S.?
Oh, there certainly are problems everywhere in the world. And I think that the difference between what we're doing and what's being done in the U.S. is that we're working in places that are absolutely resource-starved. We're working in places where, I'll give you an example of Cambodia, where 2 years ago their education budget was $96 million for the entire country. And, you know, that's less than what a, you know, medium-sized university in America spends per year. The way I look at it is if you view it as a child, as a child, as a child, and I'm looking at how do you find the places with the greatest resource deprivation where literally you can put a girl in school for $250 a year, where you can build an entire school library for $4,000, and that reaches 400 kids. So it's literally $10 per child to reach someone in Cambodia or South Africa with their first library. And in that sense, I think that we can do a little on finite resources. And I have to be honest with myself. Room to Read has finite resources. Every dollar we spend, we have to go out and fundraise. We don't have an endowment. And so in that sense, we have to spend money very, very carefully. But parents are the same everywhere. They want their children to have a better life than they've had. And that really comes down to education. Yet we live in a world today where this morning, over 200 million children in the developing world woke up and they did not put on a school uniform, they did not grab their book bag, they did not walk to school, and they did not learn. 200 million children, and this is in a time of the greatest era of wealth creation in human history. So what I'm trying to do is connect those two things, great wealth with great need.
And how important is the girls aspect of this? Because I know you have scholarship for girls, and you mentioned that two-thirds of the illiterate of the world are girls.
Yeah, I think that the lack of educational opportunities for girls in the developing world is one of the great overlooked issues of our time. Because if we can get girls' education right, it sets a baseline that every future generation can get educated. Yet if you look at, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, there are countries where only 1 in 5 girls even starts sixth grade. So why do those societies have problems? Well, if 80% of your girls who eventually become women and mothers don't even finish sixth grade, then I think that that society starts with, you know, fights the war against poverty with one hand tied behind their back or both hands tied behind their back. So Room to Read's Girls Scholarship Program is aiming to underwrite scholarships for girls and give them that guarantee that we'll stick with them through the end of secondary school and let them get a complete education. And there's a direct link between so much of what's good in the world and girls' education.
The Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen speaks of this as well, that educating girls also leads to more manageable birth rates.
Family income, family health, knowledge being passed down to the next generation. Yet there are literally tens of millions of girls who do not go to school. And I just think that's, we can do better than that. Every little girl everywhere in the world should go to school. That's just, for me, non-negotiable.
John Wood, founder of the charity Room to Read, his 2006 book about his experience is called Leaving Microsoft to Change the World, An Entrepreneur's Odyssey to Educate the World's Children. John, thanks for catching up with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, let's look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, nuclear engineering is the new hot job, and colleges are scrambling to meet the demand. Also, the last rose grower in the Northeast is closing due to foreign competition. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the man who once oversaw the massive federal budget and saw it balloon now says the U.S. is going over a cliff. He's got a tough message. The well-to-do will have to give up something, and everyone needs to save more. He's after the news, Here and Now. The United States is going broke. That's the claim made in a new documentary called IOUSA, a film one reviewer says may do for the economy what An Inconvenient Truth did for global warming.
Our current fiscal policy is unsustainable.
We can't pay our bills now.
We are headed over a cliff.
If I perform like that as a physician, my patient would die.
When IOUSA is released this Friday, the national debt will be $9.5 trillion. But we know there's a problem. Will that number or the documentary make anyone take action? Well, our next guest hopes it will. Like Al Gore before him, former Comptroller General David Walker has been crisscrossing the country promoting the film, explaining what he says are America's unsustainable fiscal policies. In February, Walker resigned as the country's top auditor in order to head the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, which hopes to build grassroots support for overhauling the nation's fiscal policies. And David joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. David, I have to ask you, you know, we've heard the talk about the ballooning deficit and the money running out for Social Security and Medicare. Now your group says Americans are going to have to give up benefits. What do you mean?
The United States is in a financial hole to the tune of $53 trillion. That's the difference between what it's promised and what dedicated resources we have to deliver on those promises in current dollar terms for Medicare, for Social Security, and then our other obligations like debt. That number is going up $3 trillion a year, even if we balance the budget. So the government has simply overpromised. We're not going to get out of the business of Social Security. We're not going to get out of the business of Medicare. It's important to have a strong, sustainable, secure safety net, and we need to increase savings, but we need to recognize reality. We're going to have to reform these programs, and the sooner, the better.
Okay, what are you saying? I mean, it's one thing, you know, Al Gore, I'm thinking of An Inconvenient Truth. The inconvenient truth is that people, you know, might have to drive smaller cars, recycle more, take personal investment and also government investment in combating global warming. Are you saying Americans, after a certain salary, might have to, you know, not get Social Security?
I'm saying that they're going to have to expect less from their federal government if they're better off, and they're going to have to expect to pay more to the federal government if they're better off in the future. With regard to Social Security, for individuals that are retired or close to retirement, you make little to no changes to what their promised benefits are because they don't have time to make adjustments. The younger an individual is, the more changes that you make phased in over time. Higher retirement ages phased in over time and indexed to life expectancy. Strengthened benefits for people near the poverty level. Somewhat less benefits for people that are middle and upper income. But on top of that, we need a supplemental savings account. Mm-hmm. Automatic payroll deduction, 2% automatic savings account on top that would go into a real trust fund with real investments, because one of the biggest deficits this country has today is a savings deficit. And that threatens our future, because with savings comes investment. With investment comes research and development. With that comes innovation and productivity improvements. With that comes improvement in our economy, our standard of living. And we are eating our seed corn as a country. We are not saving. We are not investing. And that is fundamentally imprudent.
Right. Medicare, give us a sense of how that might look.
The first thing we have to do on Medicare is decide who should receive taxpayer subsidies. If you're making over $100,000 a year as an individual, I would argue you're well off, since median household income in America is less than $50,000 a year. Believe it or not, today, an individual in that situation receives the same subsidy as somebody who is near the poverty level.
Well,
that is not right. It is not affordable. It is not sustainable. It is not equitable.
Well, and you know the argument that if someone who's making $100,000 may have a large family and live in an area where the cost of living is so high that, for instance, if they have a medical emergency, suddenly there goes the house. They would say, no. If as I get older, I need that Medicare.
I actually believe that we need to fundamentally change our entire health care system. The first pillar is to move towards providing universal coverage for basic and essential health care, irrespective of your age and irrespective of your health status. Secondly, we need to have a budget on what the federal government will spend on health care, because if there's one thing that could bankrupt the country, it's health care cost. And we're the only major country in the world that doesn't have a budget. I would argue that basic and essential health care would include things like protection against financial ruin due to unexpected catastrophic accidents or illness. It would include certain preventative and wellness care services. And it would include inoculations against infectious diseases, as well as guaranteed ability to purchase additional insurance at group rates should you so desire. We have to focus on broad-based societal needs rather than unlimited individual wants. If we focus on broad-based societal needs, we can come up with a system that is affordable, sustainable, and more equitable. But if we continue on our present path, it'll bankrupt America.
Again, how do you get Americans to accept this? When, in fact, a majority of Americans were against the estate tax, mistakenly thinking that this tax on the very, very wealthy would be a tax on them, and it wasn't. So how do you fight that kind of, misunderstanding and politics?
First, it's important to state the facts and speak the truth to the American people, because there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. People also need to understand that we're talking about the future of our country, the future of our children, and the future of our grandchildren. What the federal government is doing today is not only fiscally irresponsible, it's morally reprehensible, because we are mortgaging the future of our children and grandchildren. We're slipping them a big check rather than giving them a bequest. You have to put a face on it. And for me, the face is my three grandchildren. They didn't create this problem, but it's their problem. They're going to pay the price. They're going to bear the burden if their elected officials fail to act. Nobody can afford to write a blank check, even the United States of America. We need a system that is more rational, more equitable, more affordable, and more sustainable. And that should be our goal.
That's former U.S. Comptroller General David Walker, Chief Executive Officer of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. They've launched a campaign to warn Americans about what they call unsustainable fiscal policies. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. David Walker, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin, very much.
Well, what do you think about this or anything on the program? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can always give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. We would love to hear from you. Before we go today, a fresh look at an Oscar-winning film, The Counterfeiters. You're listening to Here and Now. Hubcaps, vinyl seats, concealed headlights, these are some of the features still found on many new car models, despite the fact that they're completely obsolete. Clifford Attia is a reporter for the Boston Globe. He's written about obsolete add-ons. Clifford, let's take the tape cassette player. Are you finding cars that still have them?
There are a few. The Lexus GS has standard cassette decks, some of the new Korean minivans that do as well, and it's just very surprising.
Well, tell us about some of the other obsolete features that you found on cars.
Well, a few of the things probably some people wouldn't agree are obsolete, like hubcaps, for example, and hood prop bars. And both of these are just kind of vestiges of, you know, of a cheap car.
So a hood prop is cheaper than a really nice hood that holds itself open.
Yeah, and a lot of the manufacturers, including GM, said that it really kind of depends on the buyer's preference. You know, especially on a Cadillac, that type of feature would not be acceptable.
But the hubcaps, now, what exactly do hubcaps do? And why do you see them as obsolete? I mean, what should they be replaced by?
Well, hubcaps typically, I mean, years ago, they were mostly sturdy metal designs. You had very intricate designs on a lot of the old Cadillacs. And today, you know, they're really, I was equating them to Frisbees, more or less. Mm-hmm. They're hard plastic. They scratch easily. They tend to warp, and you'll usually see them on the side of the road. I mean, typically, alloy wheels have decreased in cost these days. You know, I think that's kind of where the trend is moving.
And you write that the alloy wheels are lighter than steel wheels and hubcaps, and that's fuel savings. I mean, that's why a hubcap is becoming obsolete, because if you cut back on even small items, you have better fuel efficiency.
Yeah, you know, any type of fuel saving is definitely important.
You quote an analyst who says that for every 100 pounds of weight you can save, there's probably a 1% fuel economy gain.
So that's right.
Right. So let's move on. We see that in the Audi A8, the Chevrolet HHR, the Chrysler Pacifica, and the Ford Ranger, you found cigarette lighters and ashtrays. Now, aren't those still in most cars, or are car makers phasing those out?
Most vehicles today don't come standard with an actual lighter, but they do, of course, have just plastic covers, basically, for people to plug things in, like cell phones,
right,
and pagers, everything.
Some of the other things that you think are obsolete, back seats without headrests, antennas. Come to think of it, why would a car need an antenna?
I think the technology has improved. You see a lot of cars today with just either a very small stub on the roof, or it's integrated directly into the glass.
Yeah, so, because if you can have a retractable antenna, someone doesn't snap it off, even if you need it.
True. Mm-hmm. Especially in a car wash, if you forget to turn your radio off, you know, there goes your antenna, and then you have a nice pricey bill on your hands.
Just leave us with a couple other things that you think are obsolete in cars, and yet still showing up in cars.
One thing we didn't mention, like full-size spare tires, we don't really typically see that anymore. You tend to have a very thin tire in the back of the trunk, if there even is one at all in some cars.
The donut.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The short-term spare.
Other things, such as drum brakes, that's a kind of an obsolete technology when compared to disc brakes, which are much lighter and much more effective at stopping. And again, a lot of these things just come down to kind of the cost per part.
Well, let's just tick through a couple last things. Digital speedometers, you found them on Honda Civics and Toyota Priuses. But your car expert told you what? People don't really like to see the digital speedometers?
Yeah, in the most part, I mean, that's a fad, really. It really happened more in the 1980s. You saw it on a bunch of Chryslers, even the Chevy Corvette. But I think a lot of people found that the analog speedometer was just easier to glance at when you're driving. Mm. But with the digital speedometer, what happened was a lot of times it got washed out in sunlight. And people really were kind of uncomfortable with this, but it seems that some people really do like it on the Civic and the Prius, so who knows, that could be coming back.
Well, you know, speaking of which, we're talking about things that have become obsolete and you probably won't see showing up at all anymore on cars, and if they are, they're sort of, you know, useless, like a cigarette lighter for most people. But we're also seeing all these new inventions. You know, there's cameras and, you know, you have to fiddle with your GPS. Are these things going to be seen either as obsolete or too high-tech maybe down the road?
Well, essentially, I think you'll probably see some of these really high-tech gadgets trying to go back and be a little more simpler, because I think a lot of people don't like to kind of fuss with computers in their car. I definitely don't want to get into a car and try to spend, you know, half an hour trying to figure out how to switch the radio station on. It shouldn't have to be like that. So hopefully, if things improve, it'll be better.
It'll go back to the way it was.
Yeah,
you turn
hopefully.
It on with a knob.
Who would have thought?
Cliff Attia, reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, coming up, the real-life drama behind the Oscar-winning film about a Nazi concentration camp. That's in 1 minute, here and now. The Counterfeiters, winner of this year's Oscar for Best Foreign Film, arrives in stores on DVD this month. It's a fictionalized account of the Jews in Germany's Sachsenhausen concentration camp, who produced near-perfect forgeries of the British pound for the Nazis for their scheme to destabilize Britain's economy with infusions of fake currency. In the film, the forgerers are granted special privileges, including civilian clothing, weekly showers, and sheets and pillows. And that draws the disdain of others at the camp who question whether cooperation with the Nazis is justified even in the name of survival. Well, producer John Kalish says the movie missed the greatest drama in the real-life saga, some of which has been told on film and television before. It all centers around a real-life character called Sally.
Now, in the darkest days of World War II, Saleh must attempt the greatest forgery of all time, counterfeiting millions in Allied currency for the most diabolical regime in history.
The Saleh in the film The Counterfeiters is modeled after Solomon Smolyanov, a Russian Jew who was part of the Nazi counterfeiting operation at Sachsenhausen concentration camp.
He was a trained conservatory painter, but when the Bolsheviks took over, he's not a normal candidate for communist rule. And he made it to Berlin, and there was his old teacher in the counterfeiting business, Mr. Ivan Mosyadev, and they started working together.
That's Lawrence Malkin, author of Kruger's Men, widely regarded as the definitive nonfiction account of the counterfeiting saga. A paperback edition of Malkin's book was recently published with a sticker that says the true story that inspired the Oscar-winning movie. But that's as close as Malkin wants to get to the film. He rejected an offer by Austrian filmmaker Stefan Ruzewitzki to use his book for the movie, which Malkin says is seriously flawed.
It is a meretricious film. That is, it's like a painted lady. It's beautifully produced, wonderfully acted, but it's totally false. It's morally false. He sets up a moral dilemma that never took place. He basically posited a situation in which these Jews were arguing among themselves about whether or not it was morally right to work for the Nazis. There is absolutely no evidence of this in anybody's memoirs.
One of those memoirs was published in 1949 by a Norwegian typographer named Moritz Nockstern. He penned the first eyewitness account of the counterfeiting ring, or Operation Bernard, as the Nazis named it, in honor of the major in charge, Bernard Kruger. Perhaps the most outrageous element of the real-life story that the movie ignored completely involves the handful of Jews who were actually involved in laundering the counterfeit British pounds. One of these men was a Dutch Jew by the name of Jaak van Harten. And Malkin says that when the war ended, van Harten was apprehended by members of the underground Jewish army.
They point a gun at him and say, "You've been working with the Nazis." He says, "I've been waiting for you." And at that point, he hands them large bundles of these fake pounds. And they use these pounds to buy engines for the Haganah, for the underground Jewish army, lash them to the decks of ships, which are holding refugees, which they charter. Now, think of this. If ever there was an espionage blowback, and this is the point that is totally missed by the film, the grandest irony of this whole thing is that these Hitler pounds, these bills end up helping Jews get to Palestine.
The Nazi counterfeiting operation at Sachsenhausen was alluded to in the 1952 feature film Five Fingers, directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. It was based on the real story of a Nazi spy who worked at the British embassy in Turkey. The Germans paid the spy, who they called Cicero, with fake British pounds, but never acted on the valuable intelligence he provided.
You have been assigned a code name, Cicero.
Cicero? A man of nobility, eloquence, and dissatisfaction.
As improbable as it sounds, a version of the counterfeiting story was done as a comedy called Private Schultz by the BBC in 1981. Here, too, the story involves a counterfeiter known as Sally, but the protagonist is a bumbling German private, Gerhard Schultz, who reports to a Nazi major, obviously based on Bernhard Kruger.
We're going to break the Bank of England, Schultz. We're going to forge millions of English banknotes and inject them like a dose of flu into the British economy.
Playing off the German plan to drop counterfeit British pounds from planes over Great Britain, the comedy has Private Schultz himself parachuting into merry old England to try and spend the fake notes.
I thought we were going to drop them out of an aeroplane over England.
We are. But we're going to drop you with them.
Drop me with them?
Yes.
You mean jump out of an aeroplane?
Yes. Well, don't look so glum about it. They give you a parachute. All you've got to do is to spend the money unobtrusively and then get back to Germany, if you can.
Of course, the hapless Private Schultz botches his mission and ends up crossing the English Channel to France. The real Major Bernhard Kruger became a salesman after the war for the German company that provided the paper used in his counterfeiting operation. And in 1987, 2 years before he died, Kruger went looking for the counterfeit pounds the Nazis dumped deep in Lake Toplitz in the Austrian Alps during the final days of the war.
Yeah, war schön.
Kruger accompanies a German TV crew on a small submarine. He tells them he's glad that the prisoners who counterfeited pounds were spared from the gas chambers. Kruger said he did everything he possibly could and was treated like dirt, a reference to his arrest and interrogation by the British after the war. In the summer of 2000, another mini-submarine scoured the bottom of the Austrian lake for counterfeit pounds, this time in the employ of CBS News.
All right, we all hop to top.
Yep, get a visual.
Yeah.
All right.
60 Minutes to correspondent Scott Pelley and Adolf Berger, one of the Jews who helped print the fake pounds, were there watching the sub's video feed. After weeks of searching, the sub hit pay dirt.
The question was, would Adolf Berger recognize it? Could he tell us what we found?
10th June, Bank of England.
It is paper, bundles of it, inscribed with the words Bank of England.
Bank of England.
The boxes are full of cash. Millions of dollars in British pound notes. We have found Hitler's bankroll.
It was widely assumed that the Jews who did the counterfeiting for the Nazis would be shot to death. Though the Oscar-winning film The Counterfeiters doesn't show it, the operation at Sachsenhausen was moved twice in the final weeks of the war as the Allies closed in on the Germans. The Jews who printed those fake British pounds likely survived because of the chaos surrounding those two relocations. Once again, author Lawrence Malkin.
I hardly feel this is about the Holocaust at all. To me, it's a story of survival in wartime and wartime deception. The prisoners are deceiving Kruger. Kruger is deceiving the prisoners. They're all hoping to get through this terrible tunnel, and they do.
After liberation, Solomon Smolyanov made his way to Uruguay, where he was eventually expelled for counterfeiting Russian icons. Several of the other counterfeiters came to North America, including two brothers who took jobs as typesetters at a Yiddish newspaper in New York City.
Producer John Kalish in New York. For more on the story of the counterfeiters, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Manigan, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Hitesh Hatti, and Jill Ryan. Doug Sugards is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Hamad Ahmed, Colin Foss, and Rachel Conowitz. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
RI, Public Radio International.